This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When World War II veterans came home, they were met by cheering headlines and joyful parades. Vietnam vets never saw those honors. Many felt as though the country turned its back on those who had done their duty and paid a price. Our guest today is a man who lived that story. John Headley spent 24 years in the Army, and his experience in Vietnam turned into a call for action for John. He's got a bumper sticker on his desk that reads, "Never again will one generation of veterans abandon another." And he hasn't. He wrote a book, Saddle Up, The Story of the Red Scarf. And in it, he shares stories of soldiers who served with him in Vietnam. Also, he's the president of a nonprofit organization, Welcome Home Veterans. John Headley, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here. Thank you, Frank.
Tell us about that mission and how it came about, your sense that you will not let go or let dishonor fall to veterans.
Sure. Again, as you mentioned, my generation came home to an entirely different type of welcome from our war. And I don't think that we fought it any differently or than the World War II generation, the greatest generation, whatever. We fought with the same sense of integrity and valor and knowing right from wrong. I have read some things while I was researching that point out that there were probably fewer atrocities committed in Vietnam by U.S. forces than there was in World War II by U.S. forces. Most of the atrocities were committed by the bad guys, and that didn't get a lot of press. And so we went over, we did our thing. A lot of guys didn't want to go, but they were drafted, and they said, okay, I've got to go serve my country. And they went, and they did their job. And most of them, in my experience, did it very, very well and came home to a horrible reaction. From a personal standpoint, I flew into the airport at Seattle-Tacoma, and I had a seatmate who happened to have been a helicopter pilot, whose bird I'd flown in a few times into dicey situations, but he always came back and pulled me back out again. So we were buddies, and we were going to Atlanta, both of us, eventually. And so we got off the airplane in Seattle-Tacoma at night. I can't tell you what time it was, but it was at night. And we walked in, and we were in uniform, wearing awards and decorations, feeling a sense of satisfaction and pride. And we joined a bunch of guys off our airplane walking down the concourse. And in those days, of course, anybody could go down the concourse to the gate to meet anybody, right? And the sides of that concourse were filled by people screaming epithets at us, calling us rapists and druggies, baby killers, murderers, spitting on us, in some cases throwing things at us. These are our countrymen, right? I mean, these are the people we went off and fought to defend. We all thought, you stop communism there. Don't let it come here, right? And it was a horrible experience. And it got even worse for me because somebody evidently reached out and grabbed my buddy, physically grabbed him. And you don't want to do something like that to some guy just got off the airplane coming back from Vietnam, right? So he went into combat mode, and he was my buddy, so did I. And we had a little altercation with some guys and then got escorted to our gate by the police, and who said, don't you ever come back to Seattle again. And we said, don't worry, we're not going to do that. But that was our welcome. And then so you get on your airplane and you go home, and you're in uniform, and all the people on the airplane are looking askance at you, or even people getting up and moving around so they didn't have to sit next to you. You get home, and I'm an Army brat. My dad fought through World War II, so he understood. So I had a good welcome home from my family. A lot of guys didn't. Siblings didn't want to talk to them. Parents, maybe, who didn't agree with the war and got caught up in this, let's tag the soldiers with everything bad about what our politicians have done, didn't want to talk to them. Teammates who played football with, go to the local hangout afterwards to go meet your buddies, and they didn't want to talk to you. And you know, that bumper sticker goes back, of course, to the way the World War II guys were welcomed home with victory parades and, you know, down Fifth Avenue, New York, and all kinds of other places. And the sad thing is that they didn't come out for us. You know, they were the greatest generation for what they did for this country. But they abandoned us. There weren't any of those guys standing on the concourse with their World War II hats on saying, welcome home, soldier. Thank you for what you did. Thank you for your service. And so we had, even from our compatriots, you know, guys that had done what we did. And so over time, that caused a lot of guys to draw in on themselves. Right. Never put on a, you know, took their uniform and trashed it. Never admitted they'd been to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Never admitted they'd served. In my case, I continued to serve. And I continued to be in public in a uniform, which was sometimes not the best thing in the world. But we withdrew into ourselves for so long that over the years, now the standard greeting between Vietnam vets, even some guy you don't know who's wearing a hat like this, is a hug, and it's a welcome home, brother. Mm-hmm. And we welcome each other home. All right. And it's the Vietnam generation that instigated the warm welcome for these kids coming out of the current conflicts in the Mideast, with people lining the concourse and this time yelling and cheering and flags flying and bands playing and little girls giving flowers and ladies come up and giving you a hug. The type of welcome that these kids deserve.
Well, let's talk about how you came to that, because as you said, you did continue. You had a career in the military right. after your service in Vietnam. And then it was a while before you started bringing your old unit together. First of all, maybe you can tell us about that unit sure. and your part in it.
Sure. Sure. The unit is called Fox Force. It was the reconnaissance platoon of the 1st Battalion, 14th Infantry, 4th Infantry Division. And we fought in the Central Highlands of then South Vietnam. Some pretty rugged terrain, a lot of triple canopy jungle, particularly on the mountainsides and so forth. So we were in the midst of all of that. An incredible unit of young men. I mean, they were phenomenal. Probably the high point of my 24-year military career.
And you led that unit.
Yes, it was the privilege of leading those kids in combat. That's a heck of a responsibility. But I think, like most folks, I think initially I realized what we had. Can we come back and you go to a new assignment? I went to the old guard in Washington, D.C., and you get involved with what's going on there, and you go to other assignments, and all your peers are Vietnam vets, but you don't necessarily talk about a whole lot of stuff, even with the guys who were there. And it probably wasn't until and then I went to work for the defense industry, and I spent about 17 years working for Raytheon, both in the States, a lot of time overseas in Japan. Mm-hmm. And again, I think because you're so busy professionally, all this other stuff gets compartmentalized, right? And you shove it back into the dark recesses of your mind, and maybe at 2 o'clock in the morning it gets you with a nightmare or something like that. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, you try not to deal with it. But as we get older and as we get close to retirement, even the experts will tell you that these memories have a tendency to come back up again. And then you deal with them. And a lot of guys, and I say guys because there were no women in combat units in those days, and there were not a lot of women in Vietnam. But, you know, a lot of guys in their mid-60s or early 60s, all of a sudden, post-traumatic stress is hitting, and what's going on? And
is that when you decided to call for the reunions or get the reunions?
Yeah. I'd spent a long time, but I wanted to find my platoon sergeant, Staff Sergeant Jimmy Harris from Mississippi. I had a very close relationship with him, and as we traveled around, every time I got to a phone book before the internet, I looked couldn't find him. Anyway, we're in Tokyo one day around the year 2000 or so, and I get a letter. And the letter, and we're working for Raytheon, and the letter says, if you're the John Headley who commanded Fox Force in Vietnam, such and such a date, please call me. And there was a telephone number. Well, oh, my God, I'm ecstatic, right? Holy mackerel, Jimmy Harris coming out of the woodwork. And my bride, and so I'm going to pick up the phone and call him. My bride says, no, you can't do that. You got to realize it's 2 o'clock in the morning where Jimmy is. You want to call him. I said, well, he's not going to care. You know, after he's looking for me. So anyway, we made contact.
Yeah.
I arranged a business trip home. He was in St. Louis at that point, and Raytheon headquarters was in Massachusetts. So I arranged a business trip home shortly thereafter with a stopover in St. Louis and reconnected with Jimmy Harris. I'm sure a strange sight to people walking around. Again, you could go to the gate in the concourse in those days, right? And here's two older guys hugging and crying. I mean, the emotions are so close to the surface in that event. So we started talking to a couple other guys that night on the phone, decided we were going to have a reunion, and we had our first reunion in the year 2000 out in Albuquerque, New Mexico. a lot of guys afraid to go. I mean, you know, I mean, it's 1970, so it's been 30 years or more since you served with these guys. Am I going to recognize you? Am I going to know what your name is? You know, I mean, all those things got flushed or stashed somewhere. But it was such an emotional experience for us, we decided we would do it on a regular basis. So we've had a family reunion once a year. After a couple of years, we started a guys-only reunion out in Nebraska to go pheasant hunting. And just guys get together, and we don't walk through the fields quite as much now as we did then. But, you know, and we get together and tell stories and keep the relationships alive.
Well, we'll talk more about what goes on at those reunions and how things have turned out for John Headley, who's the author of Saddle Up, The Story of the Red Scarf, and the president of Welcome Home Veterans just outside of Charlotte. And we'll talk about his history and more about the group on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm talking to John Headley, who spent 24 years in the Army. He was a reconnaissance platoon leader in Vietnam for a year, and in many ways, his life was shaped by that wartime experience. His book is called Saddle Up, The Story of the Red Scarf. He shares stories of soldiers who served with him, and we're talking also about what he has done in the aftermath and what he is doing now. I suppose we should start with the story of the Red Scarf. Tell us about that in your unit.
Okay. Yeah. This red scarf is something that's very, very special.
It was, got it in your hand. You brought it with you.
Apparently, you don't
leave any place without it.
No. Anytime I talk about those kids, I've got this with me. It's part of who we are. But this was a Valor Award given to my recon platoon by a Vietnamese unit that wore them as a unit identifier. They didn't wear patches or whatever, but they wore this red scarf that set them apart from everybody else. And this occurred before I got there. I can lay no claim to whatever happened that got the scarf awarded. But it was a pretty good fight with the Vietnamese Americans, and the Vietnamese were so impressed with the way the U.S. guys had carried out their side of the mission that they Valor Award gave this. So once this was presented to recon platoon, Fox Force, we put them on and we wore them 24/7, even in the jungle.
Jungle is mostly green. And
it is
mostly red.
Mostly green. That's right.
Uh-huh.
And I think it added to some of the mystique, like, okay, get me if you can. Some of the bravado that you... I mean, it takes a very special type of man to go out and be one of a very small unit, all by ourselves. I mean, we had no support most of the time.
Doing reconnaissance, so you're way out ahead of it. You're looking for trouble.
We were looking for trouble. Our mission was to find it, not fight it. Was to find it, report back, and get other folks in to fight it for us. But a lot of times, you know, to get out of a situation, we had to fight it. So we wore these all the time. We got a POW at one point, and after he was interrogated, the word came back down from division headquarters that there was a $10,000 bounty on these scarves. Now, $10,000 for Vietnamese in 1969 is a lifetime worth of financial resources, right? And if anyone had been able to kill one of us and take the scarf off the body and turn it in, they'd have been given $10,000, never collected on, to my knowledge. But it became our identifier. I mean, and you, on the fire base, before I even joined Fox, you see the guys when they came out of the field wearing these red scarves, and even other combat soldiers kind of got out of their way and, you know, let them get in the chow line first or whatever, because it was a very, very, very special organization. We all had our scarves with us at that first reunion. No coordination ahead of time, but we all showed up with our red scarves. So we wear them any time we get together.
Well, you've talked about other situations too. A time when one of the guys who served with you was going into surgery.
Yeah,
wanted to take it with us.
Yeah,
with him.
Yeah, it's become a talisman.
Yeah. But the doctor wasn't going to let it. I mean, it's surgery. You don't want to.
Yeah, it was a VA hospital out in St. Louis, and this guy was facing a very, very critical soft tissue cancer surgery, something that didn't show up in adults, normally in kids, but because of Agent Orange, he had it. And there was a question of whether he was going to lose a leg or whether he was going to lose his life in the surgery. And I went out to spend some time with him and his wife and talking with him beforehand, and he had a scarf with him on the prep table. And then so it came time, and I left, and I went out with the family, and the door opens, and an orderly comes out and says, "Is Colonel Headley still here?" And I kind of looked around because I hadn't been called Colonel in years, right? And I said, "Yeah, that's me. Would you come in, please?" Sure. So I walked in, and my guy is lying there on this gurney, ready to go into surgery, and he's crying. And I said, "Bill, what's the matter?" "They won't let me take my red scarf in with me." Okay. So I went over and talked to the doctor, and I said, "Look, can't you put this in a sanitized container or bag of some kind? Put him under his head before you put him out so he knows it's there. You have no idea what that's going to mean to this kid to get through this surgery." Kid, guy by that time. So I went out and sat with his family, and it was, I don't know, 5-6 hours maybe, and finally surgery is done, and the same orderly comes out, and he's, and even before the family went in, he said, "Colonel Headley, we'd like to see you back here right now." Okay, so I went back, and here's my guy waving this red scarf, and he said, "Look, sir," they called me Six, my call sign, Fox Six, right? So I was Six to my guys. "Look, Six, it worked. It worked." Wow.
And well, tell me a little more about these reunions again. So clearly there's a bond, and yet you hadn't met for a long time.
No.
As you say, guys were reluctant even to get together in 2000, the first time you called us together. What are those meetings like, and what happened?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if they were reluctant so much as scared.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a scary thing. And the first reunion, and tears will enter into my story a lot for old hardcore combat veterans. Tears are a common occurrence when you get around these guys. And I sat in a hotel in Albuquerque looking at people coming in trying to say, "God, he's one of my guys, I think, but I don't remember his name." You know, that was the bad thing. But anyway, we all finally helped each other out with names because we were all suffering. And we were all embracing and welcoming each other home, and the tears were flowing. We started a tradition that we carry forward to this day. Saturday mornings is kind of an admin morning to talk about things that are going on, make arrangements for the next reunion, whatever. And we had to station one of the wives at the telephone in the conference room we were in at the hotel to call down to the front desk to get more Kleenex as we went on, because we'd just start talking about things and the tears would flow. I mean, it was incredible. I've never been through anything
had
like that.
Had they been able to talk about the? I mean, is one of the topics of conversation how hard it has been to talk about these things?
Yes, yes. Yeah. It has been over time. Yeah. And initially, when we would recount stories or try to say, "Hey, Frank, do you remember on that hill when such and such happened?" We did that after the families went to bed. Hmm. We didn't want our wives or kids to hear what we were going to talk about. And so the families would go to bed, and a couple of bottles of booze would show up, and cigarettes or whatever was going on. And we'd sit into the wee hours of the night trying to reconstruct, reconnect, reconstruct. "I don't remember you being alongside of me." "Well, yeah, damn it, I was there because I'm the one who gave you," "Oh, okay." Yeah. And for a long time it was that way. And we didn't share those stories with our families, and it took I guess probably about 5 or 6 years when we had a reunion at my house down in Denver, and a bunch of guys brought slides. And I thought, who the hell was taking pictures while that was going on, right? But guys had slides. And so we had a big tent set up in our backyard, and at night we plugged in and we started showing slides, both for each other's benefit, but of course the families were there as well. And fortunately the slides weren't any of the gory stuff, but it was vignettes of, God, you know, here's all the guys on the bunker, or here they are trying to get across this stream or whatever. So we started talking more about our experiences around our families, and that kind of drew them in a little bit.
Is that valuable? Is that the next step? Do you think that needs to happen, or is
Absolutely.
It good enough just to talk among yourselves?
Absolutely. I couldn't have gotten through this without that lady that's sitting on the other side of the glass in there. Mm-hmm. It's imperative the families understand. And one of the problems is because we don't necessarily talk about. A lot of guys don't have this benefit that I've got of being with guys that I was in combat with and I can talk to about things. And a lot of guys, they don't want to share it with their wives. They don't want their wives to know what they did, or they can't talk about it, or their kids or whatever, and it stays bottled up inside them.
And not necessarily, when you say that, know what they did. Not that they did anything shameful, but and I'm putting words in your mouth, so please correct me. Is it, well, let me ask you, why? If they didn't do anything shameful, why? What is it that they don't want?
Well, you don't necessarily want to sit and talk to your wife and kids about killing people. Mm. You know, if you look at the generation that we come from, most of us were churchgoers. We knew the Ten Commandments. We went to church every Sunday. We knew thou shalt not kill. And people don't understand a lot of times how difficult it is for a soldier to pull a trigger because he's trained not to. And he had a lot of Boy Scouts and Eagle Scouts. And, I mean, that kind of background. And now all of a sudden you're and we used pejorative terms for the bad guys. We know we called them something other than what they were to dehumanize them a little bit. Right. So that if you pulled a trigger and you killed one of them, it didn't maybe have quite the same impact. But in what I was doing, I mean, that's the way we survived. And you don't want to tell your family, but you don't want your wife to know that there's a side of you that's not really very nice, you know, because you get in that. It's a whole new you in order to survive. You become a different animal when you're in that situation.
Well, you talk about the difficulty of training a human being to take a human life and how difficult that is. And it showed up in a few ways. And then one of the more profound incidents in your book, it led to your recognizing that there needed to be some training in the use of a weapon. There was a lot of ammo being spent and not necessarily hitting its target.
Yes.
And it led to a moment that you, I think, according to the book, still have not forgiven yourself.
Yeah. You're right. I'd had the recon platoon maybe for a month, and I had noticed that when we got into contact with the bad guys, we had the ability to shoot fully automatic with our M16s. It was safe, single shot or fully automatic. And of course, when you're in it with the bad guys, you want as much stuff going down range as you can because that's little stuff coming up range. So we're going on fully automatic. Weapon has a tendency to rise. There's a natural tendency anyway when you're shooting without aiming that you aim high anyway. And it became obvious to me that we're putting an awful lot of lead out there that wasn't doing anything at all, except maybe keeping their heads down, but maybe not even that. So one time we came back in from a mission and I got with Jimmy Harris, my platoon sergeant, and I said, all right, we got to do something about this. I want to set up a rifle range outside the wire here over at the other side of the helicopter pad. And we're going to set up some targets, and we're going to do marksmanship training. And we're going to try to teach these guys single shot, or we're going to try to teach them maybe two or three round bursts. Don't just pull the trigger back and blow 18 rounds. Or if you're going to do that, control your weapon when you do that. So we spent one whole morning on the range. And as things were winding up, I got called up to the Tactical Operations Center for a briefing on our next mission. While I was there, one of the guys came up and said, "Hey, Six, you need to get down to your bunkers." And I said, "What? Why? What's going on? You need to go down to your bunkers." And so I went down to the bunkers. And the short story is, I had a couple of guys who were horsing around as soldiers do, and you go through a process to clear your weapons when you come in, and you normally put a cleaning rod down the barrel to push out anything that may be in the chamber or whatever, and so you know your weapon's empty. Well, there were two guys that were horsing around, and one guy had a .45 caliber pistol that he had not fired when he was out on the range. And while they're horsing around, pulled the trigger, and he wheeled along. That's something that I've never really fully dealt with, I don't think. It's just one of your guys that you're responsible for, and my responsibility to bring these kids home to their mothers or wives or kids, whatever. And you go into combat, you expect combat losses. That's hard enough to deal with. But a friendly fire accident?
There was a hearing, and the hearing found that there was that you were in no way responsible.
No way responsible. Everything that had to be done, should have been done, had been done. Mm-hmm. And my platoon sergeant and I, we primarily were exonerated. Okay, you can go back to your unit, Lieutenant, you're fine. But that was tough.
You talk about it in the book. You name the soldier. You go, it's a long chapter. You go into detail. I mean, I can imagine writing that. In fact, when I started reading it, I thought that was going to be the end, that this thing happened. You felt awful and you've lived with it. I thought you were going to go on. You kept going into detail and then talked about visiting with his family.
Yeah. This reunion we had at our house where we first started showing slides and so forth. I got word that Will DeLong's family was going to come to the reunion. I had written Mom a letter, of course, when this happened, that I find out afterwards she never received. When I came home again, I was all over the world on assignment, so I never got a chance to go visit family as I should have done. Just always, I mean, never anywhere close where I could get to Ohio where his family was. And when I heard his family was coming, it just scared the living stuff out of me because I didn't know what their reaction was going to be. You know, was mom going to take a baseball bat and beat my head in because her son was killed in an accident? Mom came and a daughter came and a daughter's daughter, grandchild. And I was scared. I didn't know what was going to happen. But they turned out to be the most gracious, loving people that I've ever met. Sister's name is Paula DeLong, and she's been like one of the guys. She's come to every function, every reunion, every funeral that she could get to.
Were they curious about what he was doing there?
Yes.
And wanted to know more.
Yes,
yeah.
they were. And of course, a lot of times the military tells strange stories to families about what happened with their son or husband or whatever, and. The story that they had received from the Army was something other than what had actually happened. So I got a chance to sit and talk with them and you know, basically said, yeah, this is my fault, but this is what happened. It was an accident. Guy had no intention of shooting Will, didn't know there was a round in the chamber. It's that age-old story. It was hard to recount, to sit across a table and talk with them, but they were, I mean, I got hugs and don't worry about it, John, it's okay.
Had they any inkling? I mean, was this a shock to them that this, or did they suspect? I mean, this could have been shocking news all this time. They thought he was killed in combat
could have been. I think they were told it was an accident, but I don't think they were told what the details were. I don't remember what they were told other than it wasn't right. And I've become very close with the family. I made a trip up to Ohio to spend some time with mom and finally do what I should have done years ago and go up and just talk to her about Will DeLong and how loved he was in the unit and respected and what an incredible soldier he was. And I finally got up to talk to her, I guess, a year or two before she passed away. And it closed an obligation for me that I had never fulfilled, that I should certainly have done years before. But
you know, you talk about another part of this book, and you mentioned it earlier, Agent Orange, and the number of people in your unit who have died because of complications.
Yeah. Agent Orange, when it was used, we loved it. I loved it because it killed vegetation. You know, so the bad guys couldn't hide from you. And triple canopy, chungle, not only do you have triple canopies, but a lot of time the underbrush is so thick that we could be sitting 3-4 feet away from each other, and you're a bad guy, and I'm a good guy, and you're shooting at me, and I can't see you. I mean, it's that thick sometimes. And there is, I mean, it's horrible to get ambushed and have to react to that. So when they started spraying Agent Orange, I thought it was manna from heaven because it killed vegetation and made them a lot more visible, which cut down on casualties and so forth. And there was a lot of spraying that went on in our area, and we were out most of the time. And Agent Orange would trickle down through the canopies in the water and whatever. It would obviously stick to plants, obviously, groundwater. And you breathe it. I mean, there are times, I think, where spraying was done not too long before we went in an area. So it's still in the air. So we breathed it, drank it, swam in it, slept in it, and probably ate it, I guess. And didn't realize, again, we didn't know what it was going to do to us. Agent Orange, even the government wasn't accepting or acknowledging. And we had our first reunion in the year 2000, and I lost my first guy in 2001.
To Agent Orange.
To Agent Orange-related cancers. Every one of these guys that I've lost has been of something that could be related to exposure to Agent Orange. Six.
And but there's another case now, you know, perhaps the government, we all didn't know all of what it was capable of at the time. But since then, it seems like the government we have known, and there's been less than forthcoming when it comes to reckoning with this, particularly with veterans who were affected.
Yeah, you know, in this nonprofit that I'm heading up, the Welcome Home Veterans, the majority of the population is Vietnam vets. I mean, the young guys are still working and raising families, and they don't have time to come hang out. World War II generation is disappearing on us, and Korean War guys don't have a tendency to do that. We've got a few of them, but there could be a lot more. And the stories, the common story amongst us even now, you know, we're all up in our 70s, and most of us have been home for 38 to 45 years or 50 years, actually, from that time. And it's the fight with the VA to get the benefits which you feel you are due, and to get the VA to acknowledge that what you are suffering from, in fact, probability, was caused by exposure to Agent Orange. And there's compensation that's built into that. There's a higher degree of treatment that you get out of the VA if you are service-connected.
I'm going to take a break right here. We'll continue our conversation with Vietnam veteran John Headley, dedicated his life to assuring that veterans who come home to a warm welcome, and has written a book called Saddle Up, The Story of the Red Scarf. Our conversation continues on the state of things in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm talking to John Headley. He's got a bumper sticker on his desk that reads, "Never again will one generation of veterans abandon another." After serving in Vietnam and then 24 years in the Army, well, I guess that included 24 years in the Army, he continues his devotion to veterans. He's now the president of a nonprofit organization called Welcome Home Veterans. The idea, of course, began as a coffee shop just outside of Charlotte. Tell us more about that.
Sure. When we moved to Charlotte, I guess 13 years ago or so, I retired from Raytheon about a year after we moved there. And then I thought I still wanted to do something to work, to be productive. And so I started going out and talking with folks. And one guy was a vet, and he asked me if I'd ever heard of Pat's Gourmet Coffee Shop, because a common topic when you're talking with a vet is you don't necessarily miss getting up in the morning or doing KP or whatever that, but you miss the camaraderie of people that you associate with. And so it was recommended that I go up to Mooresville to Pat's Gourmet Coffee Shop. Oh, okay, so I did. And Pat's Gourmet Coffee Shop was run by a man named was Richard Warren, and his wife was Pat. And they had set up to open just a coffee shop. But Richard Warren was a gunship pilot in Vietnam, 69-70, had a soft spot in his heart for veterans, particularly Vietnam guys. Again, no welcome, right? And because of that, and he had a gal Friday, Cheryl Ann, who worked with him, who was just an absolute delight. And they had an almost a ritual to welcome guys in for the first time and give them I can even show you a keychain with beads on it that had different colors on it. This is, of course, a Vietnamese flag, and this is the red for my red scarf. Okay? But we go through a real ceremony of presenting that. We have them sign into what's called a Book of Honor. We've got now, I think, 18,000 signatures in that book, to include a goodly number of Medal of Honor recipients and politicians and so forth. Well, this same reunion that's so key in 2005, I had talked with Richard ahead of time, and I said, look, I want to bring my guys up to get a welcome. They've got to see what you're doing here. And Saturday morning is live music morning at Richard's, and people come in and just jam for a couple hours. And I said, I want to bring them up before you open. Sure. We all went in, of course, wearing our red scarves, right? And there was 12, 13 of us, I suppose. And we walked in, and Richard had two tape decks. So, I'll tell you how modern we are, right? Two tape decks going.
Well, you gave away your age by saying you do your dancing on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, already.
Yeah. Already, yeah. That's true.
Okay.
You know, one tape deck was Vietnam-era music, and the other was a wop, 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 and Huey helicopter blades, which gets right to the heart of any instrument. Wow. And a great welcome home and a lot of emotions. And I looked around. I had all these hardcore combat infantrymen with tears streaming down their cheeks. My platoon sergeant, Jimmy Harris, a big muscular guy, sitting on a sofa just crying. So anyway, we spent some time there, and I got them together, and we left and went back home. A couple of weeks later, I went back up to Richards, and I walked in. He grabbed me by the arm, and he said, John, I got to talk to you. Let's go outside. And I thought, geez, one of my guys stole something, broke something, or, you know, whatever. And what have we done now? And we walked outside, and he looks at me with this intense look in his eyes. And he said, December of 1969, were you in such and such a place in really, really deep trouble? And I said, yeah, I was. It was a dicey situation. And he said, do you remember the first air support that you got? And I said, in all honesty, no, I don't. I was too busy talking on the radio and pulling triggers. And he said, it was me and my wingman. And they're flying Huey Charlie model gunships. And I said, how do you know that? And I don't remember you guys being there. How do you know that? And he said, because we made our first gun run, and my crew chief gets on the horn and says, hey, who are those crazy blankety-blankety-blank guys down there wearing red scarves? And the location fit, the date fit, and the scenario fit. So the end result of that is I probably owe my life and the lives of my soldiers to a guy by the name of Richard Warren.
And that was his coffee shop.
And he was sick, Agent Orange. Mm. He asked some of us if we could figure out how to form a 501c3 that he wanted to call Welcome Home Veterans. He passed away 9 years ago, right after we got the 501c3 status. I don't know how I ever repay a debt like that. So all I can do is say thanks by doing as much as I can for vets and try to pay forward for some of these young kids coming in who may need financial assistance or help getting a job or writing a resume or
whatever.
Is that
what you do? That's what the nonprofit
It's basically does. A hangout place for veterans. Yeah. I mean, we have no membership. There's no liquor license. It's just a place where you can come hang out with other guys and gals who have done the same thing that you've done. It's become an institution over the years. Thursday mornings is our big day. That's traditional free coffee for veterans. They started by Richard Beck when he first opened this thing about 20 years ago. And Saturday is live music with veterans and non-veterans come in and sit around and jam for 2 or 3 hours and produce incredible music.
Well, you talked about the intergenerational aspiration for this and your unit. I mean, when you've welcomed home people from Iraq with your red with those red bandanas. Yeah. But tell me more about that and whether or not, because I think you mentioned the fact that mostly you're seeing Vietnam-era vets at this place.
Yeah, I mean, most of us are retired, you know, so we've got the time. We can go in on a Thursday morning and sit around for 3 or 4 hours and drink coffee and BS with our buddies. The young guys are, you know, trying to find jobs or working jobs, raising families. They may not be able to get in on a Thursday. But we reach out to them. The NASCAR Tech is located in Mooresville, North Carolina.
And you are saying Mooresville because the first time I heard it, I thought it was Morrisville, but you're talking about Mooresville, which is outside of about 45 minutes from Charlotte. Right?
Yes, that's correct. Okay. And there are a lot of young veterans over at NASCAR Tech learning skills to become crewmen or mechanics or whatever. And we figured they couldn't come to us. Maybe we can go to them. So we made arrangements and coordinated with NASCAR Tech, and we went over. And we provided all of the financing and materials, and we built them kind of a small coffee shop for veterans where they could go and hang out with their buddies that they were going to school with. And we put in a place where the local VA vet could come and sit down and talk with them because a lot of these kids suffer from the same type of problems, particularly the first Gulf War with all the chemical fires that Saddam lit as he was pulling out of Kuwait. You know, that's had a horrible effect on some of these young folks as well. So,
and you talk about not only the chemical effects, and we've talked about Agent Orange and some of the other chemicals that people are exposed to in the military, but PTSD, and you don't like the D in PTSD.
I don't like the D. It's not post-traumatic stress disorder. It's post-traumatic stress without any doubt. But a disorder says, well, there's something that's not right there. Well, no. You don't go downrange and do what we did without coming back being a changed person. And most of us come back with some kind of personal demons and dragons that sit up here and vegetate for years. It's a natural result of what we did. It is not a disorder. It's not something that's out of the ordinary. And I think for us, for my generation, it's a different type of – they used to call it combat fatigue or something like that, I guess.
We used to call it combat fatigue, remember? And it was called battle shock, shell shock. Remember
shell shock and that kind of thing.
George Carlin did that routine and talked about how we'd softened that from shell shock to post-traumatic stress.
That's right.
Right.
But, you know, we went over, aside from the initial deployments when units went to Vietnam, we went over as individual replacements, and we came back as individual replacements. You know, my dad came back from the Pacific on a troop ship, and he had 2 or 3 weeks with his buddies to talk things out and get emotions out and fears and answer questions. And we didn't have that. A lot of guys came out of Vietnam 48 hours after they came out of the jungle. They were home with mom and dad, and without anybody they can detox with. And so you carry all of that bundled up inside of you, and then you throw fire on that with the type of welcome that they got when they came home, which makes it even worse.
Well, you talk about it, and are things getting better now? Because obviously we don't want to put everybody back on troop ships to bring them home. Mm-hmm. We'd like to get them home as soon as possible. But at least now the military understands that maybe putting you together with others who—
Yeah. I mean, right. I mean, now we rotate units in and out of the combat zones. We rotate brigades or divisions or whatever is aviation brigades, whatever is required. The guys train up for a year or two. They go to National Training Center and have a one-on-one with a notional bad guy force. And then they deploy as a unit with the guys they've lived with and trained with for a couple of years. And then they come back with the same guys. So it's not as traumatic for them. I mean, even if they don't have a lot of time, still there's common experience and so forth, and it's a little bit easier to deal with. Not to say that some of these kids coming back don't have their own form of post-traumatic stress because of what they may have experienced or what they may have seen.
What was this experience like for you writing this book and going back over these stories?
Very difficult. It took me 8 years, 9 years to do that. Initially, it started because as my guys were having problems, I'd go out and spend some time with them, and families or friends would invariably ask me to go spend a couple hours someplace else and tell them about what Joe had done in Vietnam for the year, because Joe, like most folks, didn't talk about that. And these guys were such a phenomenal bunch of young men that I wanted somehow to document what they had done so that after they went away, their wives, kids, relatives, friends would have some idea of what they experienced, and also to set the record straight and let people know we weren't all baby killers and druggies and rapists and potheads. And initially, that's what it was going to be for, a very small audience, and I didn't even think I was going to publish it. I might have run off a bunch of pages and stapled them together or something and handed them out at a reunion. But as time went on, people would ask me for samples of things that I'd written. My West Point class has published a book, the last two reunions, called Both Sides of the Wall, Vietnam Memorial, Stories Before and After, Cadet Days, whatever, Vietnam After. And it's just a compilation of stories from anybody who wants to donate one. And after some urging of a classmate of mine, I sat down to write something. The editor called me and said, you need to write because your roommate here says you got some things you can write about. And initially I said, I can't do that. I don't know how to write about this stuff. She said, just a chain of consciousness, just think and write. But I said, you're liable to get a whole bunch of four-letter words. And I mean, if you want me to go back in there and start thinking, She said, don't worry about it, John. I'll take care of that. Yeah. But just write. And so that's what started this. I'd never done this before. I didn't know how to write a book. I didn't think I knew how to write. And as time goes on, I'd send pieces of this away to my classmates who are published authors and say, what do you think? And the written result was normally pretty good. And then my daughter, who graduated from Penn State about 12, 13 years ago, had a really good buddy who went into the Air Force, and he's still in the Air Force. And he's a real hard charger, and he's trying to set himself up with something for after service. And so he got together with a bunch of people to start this publishing company called A15. And A15 is staffed by veterans, and they deal only with veterans. It's a very small organization. And so they were putting together one of their first publications was going to be a book entitled There We Were, which again was a compilation of war stories. And my daughter's buddy, whose name was Zach, contacted me and said, your daughter tells me you're writing. Can you send a couple samples of what you're writing? Because we want Vietnam stories in the book. So I sent a couple of notional chapters in. And again, the reaction I got was very positive. And the question was, can we use both these chapters in that book that we're going to publish? And I said, no, No, you can have one, but you can't take two because I may wind up publishing this thing myself.
There you go. So now you're going to publish. Well, yeah. But it seems to me that in doing this and the number of times where you've really had to pause and gather yourself just in this conversation, that what you're doing is what your unit did in some ways, that you go out looking for the trouble and then go through the trouble or bring it back and report on it. But that you have to engage the trouble first. You have to go looking for it. And that's the hard part, isn't it?
It is. And you know, one phase of post-traumatic stress counseling is in a group with a facilitator. Yeah. In most cases, those facilitators have never walked down that trail in the jungle, so they can't really relate to the emotions that bubble up if you hit the right button on a guy. But, you know, they tell you after you've been through that that the best way to deal with your demons and dragons is to write them down. Mm-hmm. That's a real hard thing to do sometimes. It's hard to face that. It generates nightmares. It generates tears at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're trying to write it down. But they're told that if you can write this down and look at it, then you've faced it, and then you're better equipped to deal with it. The memories are never going to go away. Mm-hmm. The post-traumatic stress is never going to disappear, but you might have a better handle on what's bothering you so that you're more equipped to deal with those times you go into your dark space, and you can let your family know what's going on in your head when you get into that, so that overall it'll be a big help. And I think now as I look back on this, and I mean, I'm talking to you about things I didn't talk to people about for a long, long time. But it's become easier, and it's become easier to face some of the things. You asked me about Will DeLong, man, and you almost brought me to tears because that hasn't gone away. Mm-hmm. But at least now I can talk about it, you know, and some of the other situations that are in that book I can now talk about. And I've spent a lot of time with this wonderful lady I'm married to at times, just unburdening with her She's been absolutely incredible.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the time you spent with us and for your service and for the book that you've written and the work that you're doing. John Headley, president of Welcome Home Veterans. It runs out of Richard's Coffee Shop on Main Street in Mooresville, just outside of Charlotte. And on Thursdays, veterans get free coffee and dancing, I guess, on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
All right. Look up. The book is called Saddle Up, The Story of the Red Scarf, and you can find out all that information at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.